available in more homes than the Pac-12 Network, we are the Podcast of Champions. Fight! I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online.
And here he goes, Miles Jack.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com.
Liner going to try to sneak it ahead. Touchdown, SC!
We are the Podcast of Champions. Welcome, everybody, back to the Podcast of Champions. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site on the Scout.com network.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com, the USC site on the Scout.com network, and we are the Podcast of Champions. If you'd like to email us, our email address is Pac12podcast@gmail.com. You can tweet us on the Twitters, at Pac12podcast, our website, Pac12podcast.com. And if you want to call and leave a voicemail, you can do that too, 641-715-3900, extension 734-972. Leave us a voicemail. We'd love to play it on the next Pac-12 podcast, whenever that may be. We just don't know at this point. But we're getting close to the season, Dave, and I'm really excited about our guest for today.
Yeah, we get Ted Miller today. Ted, how are you, man?
Outstanding. I like that intro there. Wow.
We didn't really give Ted – well, you can follow Ted on Twitter, at Ted Miller RK, at Ted Miller RK does a great job. He's out there in Arizona. Great job covering the Pac-12 for years. And we want to kind of talk about your current situation now, Ted. But yeah, we really appreciate you having on. We had you on probably a couple years ago, I think, talking Pac-12 at like one of the Pac-12 media days, I think.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed the detente of this show between you Trojans and Bruins. It just warms the cockles of my heart.
Yeah. We kind of bridged the gap with just general snark about both of those programs. And I provide it generally for UCLA, and Ryan provides it generally for USC. It's great. It's wonderful.
Well,
so much love in the air.
There's love, and we do appreciate you kind of coming on and talking about the Pac-12. We got Pac-12 Media Days coming up, and hopefully Dave and I will be doing more frequent shows, more than every couple of weeks or so. But, you know, we texted you. There was a whole lot kind of going on. I don't know if you want to give kind of people a general, hey, here's what's going on with Ted Miller right now, just for, you know, from the whole ESPN thing and everything.
You know, I was among, and it wasn't just ESPN, but ESPN was the lead in the AP story, so to speak, on it, was that I was among the cuts on April 26th, over 100 people. Some of them made it very public. Some of them were pretty quiet about it. But it was a lot of people who have been doing sports journalism and sports TV for a long time. And it was I was completely shocked. I'm still under contract for another year until May of next year, so I'm fine. And I've had some stoves in the fire, so to speak, with a couple of places. And, I'm hoping that I'm going to get something that's going to be worth my while to stay in the business. And so, hopefully even cover this football season. I don't know what's going to happen yet with that, but, we'll see. And, it was across everybody. I mean, it was, I had sympathetic, communications with people that shortly thereafter found they were losing their jobs at Sports Illustrated or Fox or even Bleacher Report and some of these other sites. I mean, everybody was trimming house sporting this. So it's sports journalism is at a crossroads, especially the written form. I mean, Fox is going entirely to video. I'll say for the record, I think that's completely stupid. But I mean, those are people who do metrics and have all sorts of insights into the audience today. So maybe I'm wrong, but that's kind of where it is. I mean, people who are sports writers who write about this primarily, I mean, I've done videos, I do podcasts, I do radio, but my bread and butter is writing stories, and that right now is a questionable enterprise if you have a good job.
I think, we've all kind of, we've all kind of had that morbid talk about, sports journalism is dying, and that's been going on for like 10 years now, 12 years now. What do you, it seems like, and I think you've touched on this, but like everyone's trying to reinvent the wheel and all this different stuff, trying to go full video at Fox Sports, and that's not even just sports journalism. I think MTV is going full video with their newfound like long form site. Does this all seem kind of crazy to you? I mean, do you have any insight into why there is always this kind of trying to reinvent the wheel with different technological offerings with sports journalism?
You mentioned MTV. And I think that's a perfect example, is that, you know, some of this is going to be dated because our audience in some places is going to be a lot younger than their 40s. But in the 80s, MTV just became a juggernaut, a cultural juggernaut. The rock video was the biggest thing. I mean, if you were in high school in the 80s, you had to keep up with the rock videos. Like, that was the most important thing. It wasn't the songs as much as seeing the premiere of the new Madonna video, the new Motley Crue video. I mean, it was just an absurdity that this stuff mattered as much as it did. And I remember listening to the guys in REM making fun of it, and I thought they were idiots. Rock music videos are the new medium. It's a new art form. You combine music and video. Well, guess what? Rock videos are dead, and what survived? Music. People still like music. And I really do believe that this, the kind of the executive level self-justification of a product changing constantly for an audience and going viral or whatever, I think that you have to participate in that, but that needs to be secondary. To me, quality work always prevails. And markets change, the business changes, and, you know, sometimes the revenue changes. And part of the problem with having stockholders is they always want to see new streams of revenue, and that blocks out long-term thinking. I think that someone is going to say, if we give people the best quality product and just say we're going to stick with that, that's going to prevail in the long term. I mean, I have a friend who's a Facebook millionaire. He got out of Facebook. He's now just kind of just independently wealthy. He's a comedian and et cetera. And he told me, like, clickbait. He thought clickbait was the interesting thing to look at now, is that you even see it, is that people get bored after a while of hitting those links, you know, top 10 Hollywood romances, top 10 Hollywood rivalries, biggest, you know, idiots in Hollywood. And you click that, and it's not rewarding. You go there, and it makes you hit like 10 slides, and you're just eventually like, ah! And so you stop clicking it, and then clickbait dies. And so you wonder what's next. And I think that I think a cleaner presentation of stuff, giving people control over the content they get, and not forcing ads down their throat constantly, is going to be the new way to do this. And I think we're going to see that. I think eventually subscription rates will work. And I think that people will pay for good quality content from reporters who know what they're doing. And that's just my hunch. I just always feel like the audience eventually drifts back to quality.
Yeah, and I don't even think it's like that super long term. I think what a lot of these companies kind of run into is short term versus long term thinking. Because in the short term, yeah, I guess, you know, going full video and doing a bunch of pre-roll ads that show up before a video, yeah, that's going to generate some money. But in the long term, you're going to turn off basically everybody who watches this, because if anybody was paying attention to the response to the Fox Sports thing, it was all these people who go to those sites saying, I never watch videos. This is going to make this site insufferable. So it might work for 6 months or a year and generate some more money, but in the long term, you're killing your business. And it just, it's hard to think how they're actually doing any kind of forward thinking whatsoever.
Well, I would just say to someone, you know, say the average, your listener right now, I would say to the person, all right, try to think of the last 10 videos you've looked at in any sports sites. And most of them probably won't even be able to remember which ones they are, but like, what was the best thing you got out of any of those videos? And, you know, they'll be stumped, because it's kind of like this mind candy that doesn't do anything. And, you know, I think you would find a lot of them would say, well, have you read any good articles lately? Could come up with a pretty good article they read that moved them or affected them, or, you know, it might not even be sports. It'd just be something else. But I mean, I just think that comes down to the video stuff is this mind candy, and it's going to lose its traction, I think, with people, especially because it's just regurgitated. You know, it's dumbed down. It's regurgitated. It's, you know, hey, so what do you think of the key in the Stanford USC game is going to be? Well, I think when Stanford has the ball, they're going to really want to score some points, and USC, conversely, is going to try to stop them. They're going to try to put up a defensive wall and keep Stanford out of the end zone. Whereas Stanford, when they have the ball, they're going to be aggressive. They want to score points. They're going to throw the ball. They're going to run the ball. They're going to try to score more points than USC. And at the end of the game, the team that has the most points is going to win this thing, I guarantee it. And that's the kind of analysis you get sometimes on those sound bites. And it's, you know, it's the inflection. You're like, wow, I'm hearing something really interesting. And then you realize, no, I'm not.
Yeah. Ted, I think you just got a job.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're on primetime right now. I mean, that was a head-on impression of a few people I can think of.
Dave, kind of along those lines, Ted, you know, we're talking about the television and the videos and all that stuff. I wanted to talk about the Pac-12 network a little bit. I mean, the numbers that keep coming out as far as discrepancy between, you know, what like a USC or UCLA makes compared to like a Rutgers. It just seems to be the gap is widening quite a bit. And, you know, they got the Pac-12 is in this long-term contract. We don't even know what the future of TV rights are. I mean, I don't know what you feel about it. If you feel like the Pac-12 kind of signed their life away and they're missing this boom that's going on that, you know, could go away with all the cord cutting too.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the full ownership thing, I think that so there's some people over the Pac-12 network that maybe think that they're, you know, crazy like a Fox in the sense that there's a complete ownership and that if things go a la carte, that pays off in the long term. There's an impatience there. I understand that completely. I mean, I think that almost all the schools thought they were going to be making more money right now than they are off the network. And, you know, and I'll be honest, I mean, I've communicated with the Pac-12 network and I think I could help them. I think I could be, I think I could pay off as a guy that could, you know, help the Pac-12 network cause, so to speak. We'll, you know, we'll see if anything comes of that. But, you know, I think that it's easy to judge what's going on at the Pac-12 network. I think that there was a lot of justification for the dice roll they made initially. It made a lot of sense. And it seemed a little psychic in some ways with the cord cutting because they didn't tie themselves completely to the idea of cable as being the only way to do it and ownership of this thing. If it becomes a la carte, owning that thing means that, you know, you have subscription rates. And I think that you'd have more people, a very specific subscription rate where like I'm a West Coast football fan. I'd pay $5 a month for the Pac-12 network. In fact, I may cut the cord myself at some point, and I would buy the Pac-12 network. Why? Because I like Pac-12 football. I like Pac-12 sports. That's why I would buy it, and I think that might be the future where everybody just, instead of having 750 channels of which you watch four, would just go through the list and pick out the top 50, and then you'd end up watching them all, and I think that might be the model. You know, you'd be watching on your phone or your pad or whatever, but I think you can still make a justification that in the long term it might work out, but you know that doesn't help anybody in the short term when they're expecting, you know, $2 or $3 more million per year, and they're watching the Big Ten and SEC just make so much more money, so much more revenue that there's a disproportionate profit among the Power Five schools. So you have, you know, subsets within the Power Five of the top two conferences, and then the top, you know, the top teams in those top conferences. So, you know, all Power Five schools obviously are not created equal. And I'm sure that folks at USC think, you know, you know, we're one of the top 10 revenue producing football programs in the country. And some of them might feel like they're weighed down by the equity of the Pac-12's deal. I'm going to leave that up to the decision makers at the schools in the Pac-12. But I mean, I do think the Pac-12 network probably has a pretty decent shot of figuring this thing out, and I think the total ownership might actually pay off down the road. I'm not sure if that's much consolation, but that's what I feel.
Yeah, I think if you're taking a long view, just looking at the trends with all of cable and everything, you know, with ESPN and with a bunch of different companies, that, you know, with the hemorrhaging of subscribers from different cable networks, you know, there's going to be at some point the piper is going to be paid, but it is that balance between short term and long term. And, you know, what I'm always kind of curious about, and I'm not sure if there's like a perfect answer for it, but how does that revenue gap play out? You know, is it strictly in coaching salaries? Is it in recruiting funds? What's your sense of it? You know, when you hear things like the SEC is going to make, what is it, Ryan, like 4 or 5 times per school than the Pac-12, or is it even more than that?
Yes, it's pretty bad. It's something like
it's crazy.
That.
But when you hear something like that, I mean,
well, it's not an exponential number, but it's a significant percentage more.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
It's not like double, but it's a lot.
What's your sense of how that plays out in terms of what it actually means to the program and to, you know, the varying degrees of, you know, of Power Five schools?
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of times when something seems like a boom industry and everybody starts to say one thing, that the opposite ends up being true. I was a stock picking genius in the 90s. You guys, I was so freaking smart. I remember the day I said to my future wife, the way things are going now, I can retire in my 50s, was the day, of course, everything started to go to hell. Just as it went with real estate. Everybody, real estate more. No, this is natural. Housing is the one thing that's just wrong. You know, I mean, so you got to wonder if you're a school that's spending twice as much as everyone else on facilities and coaching staffs and all these things, is it going to be endless? I mean, are the next round of broadcast contracts going to be better than this round? Is Alabama going to continue to be Alabama when Nick Saban retires? You know, yeah. What happens if Alabama can't lure Dabo Sweeney down and they hire some coach? He's mediocre. And let's remember, I mean, that there was a pretty fallow period after Bear Bryant there. Now, I know that Gene Stallings won a national championship, but that's a program that struggled and meandered around for a long time and had Louisiana Tech taking a knee in Tuscaloosa because they whooped them, you know? So these things can change pretty rapidly. And I think that people predicting dire things, I mean, that's usually not the way it's going to play out. I think the college football fans in general need the sport to have a lot of teams that are competitive. You know, I'm a personal believer, you call me a socialist, but I do think there should be some type of limits on the size of coaching staffs. I think that everybody should be kind of playing the same type of game at the collegiate level, where you have, you know, 9 assistant coaches and maybe 9 support staff members, or maybe 20 support staff members, but you cap that number so it's much more equitable in terms of the competition level. A lot of people disagree with me. I know Andy Staples vehemently disagrees with me. We've argued about this before, but I just feel like this idea of keep continually throwing money at these issues kind of gets ridiculous. And I think that's eventually going to bite some of these teams in the butt, including some of these high revenue teams. I mean, hey, let's take our team to Europe. Let's spend $8 million to have them touring Italy, and that'll be a recruiting thing a la Jim Harbaugh. Well, eventually some of that stuff kind of, you know, you wonder if it becomes a burden for the program, and there's a backlash, and the economy goes down, including the broadcast deals, which we're seeing now. So I think there's a little bit of an overreaction. I think the inequity is I think 20 years from now, there'll be different issues facing college football than we're fretting about now. And I don't think it'll be like, we won't be looking at USC and UCLA and saying, man, they're no longer playing big time football because it's just became like 10 teams on the East Coast. That's just not going to happen. That's not how the sport is organized. You need that regional sense across the country. Now, might there be some contraction where you only have 40 teams in the Power Five or in the major league level in college football? You know, does it become completely professionalized 10 years down the road? Maybe. But that's a different model, and I'm not smart enough to figure that out.
Hey, Ted, we got an email, and I was going to read it on our last show we did, but I'm glad I got to save it for you. I didn't even realize this was happening. I apologize. I didn't write down the name of the person that emailed it to me, but it's a little bit of an issue as far as Pac-12 bowls go. So I'll read it to you. Bear with me. He says, now that we can expect to see Fox, a big player in Pac-12 football programming, as it will be broadcasting both the USC-Stanford and USC-Texas game to start the 2017 season. We're noting that FS1 will get its first ever bowl telecast in its 4-year history of the network. It's taking the Holiday Bowl away from ESPN, which had the Holiday Bowl since 1978. When FS1 airs this year's Holiday Bowl, December 28th from San Diego, featuring the usual Pac-12 host against a Big Ten team, kickoff will be at 6 p.m. So far, so good. But you ask, what's airing over on ESPN then? Well, as it so happens, at the very same time, ESPN will be showing the Alamo Bowl, which we don't have to remind you also features a Pac-12 team against a Big 12 school. This can't help the Holiday Bowl, which drew the top cable viewership last December 27th, like 4 million people, and was down from the USC-Wisconsin game the year before. And we can't help but asking, how does the Pac-12 and two of its highest profile bowl matchups end up competing against itself?
Well, that's just awful. I mean, you know, I was thinking that for some reason, you know, you and I discussed it before we went on, like that, you know, it was Alamo Bowl versus one of the lesser things, which would be more justifiable. I think you'd have some Pac-12 fans that say that, you know, they root for their team, but they're not, you know, they're more pro fan based. They're not like the SEC where they watch every single SEC team in the bowl game, that they watch their team and that's it in the Pac-12. Nonetheless, it does. I mean, it's not a good thing for the Pac-12 by any measure. And I you'd hope that there would be administrators who would politely say to Fox and ESPN and the bowl games, by the way, hey, you know, let's not do this. This is just silly. This is bad for the conference. You know, we're partners in this. ESPN is, you know, in some ways a partner with Fox. So there should be a way to work this all out and to not have this situation. And, you know, I negotiating those TV deals and all that type of stuff, that's not my bailiwick. But that is a stupid situation. I think everybody would agree with it that it's just stupid. And if I were still working, I might try to find out why it's happening. I'll leave that to one of you guys to figure out exactly the justification for doing that.
Yeah, and I wonder how many other leagues have similar issues that we just don't hear about because, you know, we're way over here on this coast. You know, whether, you know, an SEC school runs into this or if it's just, you know, if it's just something that kind of happens to the Pac-12 a little bit more, because we've seen, like, some scheduling issues as well. I think whatever school it was it Arizona 2 years ago that went the entire season without a bye week?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
USC, yeah, this year. USC won't have one this year.
That's happened. Yeah, that's just a scheduling reality. I mean, I've had those explained to me. I mean, that is what you're making a good point. I mean, sometimes it's a matter that just putting the dates together with traditions for the communities and all these things, and it just works out that way. I mean, you know, sometimes a team is going to be playing 8 games in a row at 7:30 p.m.
And UCLA,
it stinks for its fans, it stinks for its players. Yeah, I mean, that's just how it goes sometimes. And, you know, part of that deal is that when you sign big money TV contracts and you're all happy about getting all that money is that you yield control. They're buying control of these scheduling of these games from the programs. So that's kind of how it works. I mean, it's not like there's honestly, there is no one in a corner somewhere going, ha, 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 ha. I'm going to ruin everybody's fun by scheduling these two bowl games head to head. I don't think it's how it works like that.
You just worry about, is it incompetence? Is that why it happens? You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, is it possible that somewhere in this process, someone did a bad job? Yes.
Yeah. Hey, David, I thought you want to go over the odds. Maybe we can go through each team individually and we can get everyone's thoughts. You want to do that?
Yeah. Let's buy or sell these odds.
Okay. So I'm going to start at the bottom. These are from Bovada. These are the odds to win the Pac-12 championship game. So I'll play our little theme music and then Ted will kind of get your thoughts on this team if you think the odds are right and then, you know, any kind of notes or whatever you have. And Dave and I can chime in afterwards and we'll move on to the next team. But first up at 500-1 to win the Pac-12, we have
California Golden Bears.
You know, I think that there's going to be near unanimous sentiments at Pac-12 media days. Maybe not because people are contrarian about the champion, but I think USC is going to be at the top of almost everybody's ballot, and I think Cal is going to be at the bottom of everybody's ballot. I think some people might put Arizona there, but they're not looking at the schedule. I mean, Cal has got a tough schedule, a new coach, very little talent and no returning quarterback, which 11 other teams can say they've got some experience behind center. And in the Pac-12, that usually is a pretty good thing to have. I definitely think that if you were going to put $100 on Cal, you'd probably be burning $100.
Yeah. Yeah. This is light on fire odds. I wouldn't take this. I think I wouldn't put a dollar up for $500 here. Like I would not do it. I need that dollar for other things.
I'm just like, I didn't understand Justin Wilcox as defensive coordinator. I certainly don't understand him as head coach. I mean, who knows? Maybe he'll prove me wrong, but that's just, I don't know. It seems a bit of a stretch and they just seem to be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. You know, it was an interesting hire. I mean, I really liked Justin Wilcox when I knew him at Boise State and, you know, at Washington even, but at USC, he just kind of like seemed like he kind of lost his mojo. He just looked like he was unhappy and, you know, he lost all that weight and just seemed kind of grumpy. And maybe when he went to Wisconsin, he regained whatever he lost there. I mean, even when he was successful, he didn't look really happy at USC. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting hire. I will say this. Wilcox decided to pay his staff very well and to not ask for a bunch of money for himself. And that allowed him to hire a pretty good staff. So if I were a Cal fan, this may not be a very fun season, but I have my fingers crossed in an optimistic way over Wilcox having a chance to do a pretty good job there. He's worked for some pretty good coaches, so, you know, he knows how things work.
We were at I guess it was Levi's Stadium during Pac-12 championship game with Stanford, and Justin Wilcox, you could hear him screaming because the
I almost went back there and told him that everybody was you're not supposed to get involved as a media person, but I just, the milk of human kindness is like, dude, everybody can hear you.
Yeah, Lindsay Theory's live tweets of that whole thing were the highest of high comedy. I think she was probably sitting right by the wall, and so she could hear it all. It was great.
I put a couple of like videos where I just was like filming the field, but you could hear him screaming through, and it was really Christian McCaffrey just running all over them. And I was like, well, maybe you want to cover him as opposed to just yelling in this press box. I'm not sure what's going to happen. It was bizarre. But we wish Cal the best of luck. 501, though. So if you're a Cal fan, you can make some cash. Maybe the athletic department can put a lot of money on that because they're in trouble, right? So they, you know.
Let it ride. Let it ride, Cal.
501.
They've got some issues.
Let what ride.
Let's go next up. We have two teams tied. We'll start with
Oregon State Beavers.
And they're 100-1 to win.
Well, you know, I will say this about Oregon State is that Oregon State is not going to win the Pac-12 next year, but they're going to beat some people who underestimate. I mean, I think Gary Anderson is creating a team the way he wants to create a team, which is what he wasn't getting to do at Wisconsin with Barry Alvarez kind of dictating how business is run. Everybody's acted like that was purely an academic issue. I don't think it was that way. I think that Barry Alvarez was trying to tell Gary how to coach, and Gary's now at Oregon State, and he's building a program in his own image, which is kind of stressing some toughness and his own offensive scheme, his own defensive scheme. And I think that Oregon State is a good threat for a bowl game this year. I think they're going to upset somebody who's good, but I certainly am not putting on any money for them to win the conference, especially in the North. I think that they've got a lot of teams to jump over.
Yeah, I'd feel better about 100-1 if they were in the South. Like that might be something, you know, worth looking at, but there's just, you know, you've got Washington, Stanford, Washington State, who are all probably better than
top
Oregon
25
State.
Teams. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you've got, I mean, Oregon is probably going to be improved this year. That's a tough road. And, you know, I think you're right. I think they're going to be a bowl team this year. I think they, you know, have a chance to be, you know, they're definitely on the upswing, but 100-1 in the North is just, that's too rich for me.
Yeah, the North is really tough. And we're, you know, I don't want to speak for Dave, but I think we're both Gary Anderson fans and Beaver fans. We like to see, you know, especially when Ryan Nall runs over people. We love that. But, you know, winning, I think Ted's right. I think this is a, you know, we talked about Colorado trying to make a bowl game, then they end up winning 10 games. I think the same thing could happen with Oregon State, not necessarily 10 wins, but, you know, go from the keep moving up, get better every year, make a bowl game. And like Ted said, beat somebody you don't expect them to beat. So, yeah, I think on the upswing for sure, winning the North, I mean, it's going to be so tough in the North. I just don't see it happening. All right. Well, the other team that's 100-1 is – oh, wait. It's – yeah, this one.
Arizona Wildcats.
Yeah. That makes sense to me. Here's a couple of things about Arizona. And you're going to hear me, Brent, as we talk about teams. Conference misses. The inequity of conference misses this year is almost funny for some teams. Arizona's North misses are Stanford and Washington. That, I think, just that is going to keep Arizona from finishing last in the South. I think that somebody else is going to finish last in the South. Because I look at Arizona's roster and I see some potential for improvement at quarterback. I see some good running backs. I see a veteran offensive line. I think the defense is going to be much better in second year under Marcell Yates. I think he had a lot of stuff going on for himself off the field, personal, after he moved from Boise State. I don't think he's as distracted as he was last year making that transition. And I think Rich Rodriguez is probably best when he's a little crispy, when he's a little angry, and I think he's angry. And I think Arizona is going to be a team that's going to scrape out a couple wins that we don't see coming, and the schedule is going to help them. Are they going to win the South? No. But, you know, 2 years ago, no one picked them to win the South, and they did. So, you know, maybe they've got a couple of Scooby Wrights tucked away on defense that we don't know about right now. They're going to break out and make that defense a lot better. I mean, they don't have a ton of talent. There's no one on that defense that makes you go, oh, my gosh, at least right now. A couple guys in the secondary are solid, but I mean, I don't, you know, in the Pac-12, just as a general blanket statement, I think the only easy out this year is going to be Cal. Otherwise, I think everybody is going to be good enough to beat you.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair. And you know, looking at it, the road slate isn't as bad as it could be. They do have 5 road versus 4 home, but you know, USC is a loss no matter where you play them. Cal on the road, you know, that's a game. You know, if you can have Cal on the road versus UCLA on the road, I think you'd take Cal on the road because that's a road game you can win. And then you can probably beat UCLA at home. If those were flipped, you know, UCLA on the road, that's a little bit more difficult of a game than Cal on the road. So, yeah, I think they've got not even a puncher's chance, but like if you know, every other team slips and falls badly, they could maybe do something crazy, but I don't see it. But yeah, I think 100-1 is about right.
They had 20. So two years ago, Arizona wins the South. Last year, 1-8 in conference. So it's got to get better. I don't know if it'll get good enough.
You know, yeah. If we're going to look at a scenario in the South of where one of these teams that's not highly thought of wins it, I mean, and I don't like speculating on injuries, but let's just throw out hypothetically if USC lost Darnold at quarterback, and USC obviously through the years has done some of its worst work when everybody, you know, is handing them bouquets of roses.
Exactly.
Speaking in rainbows about them. So, you know, there's still that. Clay Helton doesn't seem like the type of coach who's going to, like, get distracted by that, like Steve Sarkisian, like Lane Kiffin would. So I don't think that's going to happen. But if you do write a scenario for one of these long shots in the South, it's going to have to involve something weird happening at SC. Because I'll just say it right now, USC I'd be shocked if they don't win the South. I mean, I just think they're a lot better than everyone else.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, so next up, we got their neighbor at 50-1.
Arizona State Sun Devils.
Yeah, you know, I think that Arizona State's misses are Cal, that's not good for them, and Washington State, which is kind of good, but not necessarily. I think that the Arizona State game is going to have probably the exclamation point for one of those two teams having a good or bad season. And I think the loser of that game may be looking for a new head coach. So, you know, I think Arizona State's got some talented players. They can't possibly be worse on defense. Phil Bennett, the new hire as defensive coordinator, he's a proven commodity in terms of coordinating a defense. And, you know, they've got some pretty good players on offense. So I definitely think if Arizona State stays healthy and does its thing, that it's a bowl team plus. And it could be a team that moves up in the standings if things come together correctly. Now, they've got questions on their offensive line, and I always get kind of nervous with teams that are not very good on the offensive line. So that has to be answered. But, you know, ASU's got the talent to be a lot better than they were last year. Last year was just kind of a disaster in a lot of different ways. And you know, you talk to the folks there, they'll point at injuries, you know, using 4 or 5 quarterbacks at various times. Arizona State is definitely not going to be a bad team. And, you know, Todd Graham knows that he's got some pressure on him. So time to put up or shut up. And, you know, that rivalry in the state of Arizona could get very interesting by season's end.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting entering that conference season because they've got San Diego State at home and then Texas Tech on the road to close out non-conference play. And those aren't ideal games to be playing right into conference play. Going on the road to Lubbock and then get Oregon at home. How they do in those two games and how it, you know, kind of affects the start of conference play could be pretty interesting for them.
Well, dude, Oregon, Stanford,
yeah.
And you get an off week in front of Washington. That's a pretty tough little. I know Oregon and Stanford kind of like don't have that pedigree they might have had 2 years ago, but I mean that's a rugged start to your conference schedule.
Then it doesn't stop. It's at Utah, USC, and then you know Colorado's probably going to take a step back this year, so you get them on November 4th. But you'd love to have an Oregon State somewhere in there, or even Washington State. I think replacing Washington, even though Washington State's going to be good too. They're a little bit more volatile than very consistent Washington.
Well, I mean, you know, like we said, the teams that miss Cal in the South, Arizona State and Utah, have, you know, that's a notch against them. I'm sorry if I'm piling on Cal here, but like it is, if you're missing Cal this year, you're missing out.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you talk about Arizona State. Both, if I'm not mistaken, both teams return 7 offensive players and 7 defensive players, starters. Arizona won 1 Pac-12 game last year. Arizona State won 2. Both head coaches are in their 6th season, and you're kind of saying that it's probably only room for one of them left in the Pac-12, that, you know, both of them are probably not going to make their seventh season. That would be really interesting. I mean, there's a lot of hot seat talk, but that could be a bowl game to keep your head coach.
Yeah. I mean, in this day and age, I mean, I think both of these guys are good college football coaches. I don't think anybody would argue with that. In general, are they great college football coaches? I don't know. Most people probably say no, but in this, you know, we don't have a lot of patience in big time college football. And even though both of these guys strung together some nice seasons, you know, the last couple of years, things have been taking a downturn, and a third year downturn is something that you can't make excuses for. You can't just say, well, let us get our recruits in, or, you know, we're young. That doesn't work when you're in season 5 and 6. So that's kind of how it works. I mean, there's a lot of pressure. And like I said, I think that game, the rivalry game, the Territorial Cup, will be very meaningful. I know for Arizona and Rich Rodriguez, winning that game at the end of the season this past season, was very important for their kind of state of mind and their feeling about their program.
Well, the next two teams are both in the South also, the Mountain teams. We're going to start with 33-1.
Utah Utes.
Well, you guys know I was on the Utah bus last year, and I feel fairly vindicated. You know, they didn't end up winning the South, obviously, but that was a good football team, and the NFL loved them. I mean, what do they have, 8 draft picks? Utah, the first 2 years in the Pac-12, had the big benefit of missing Oregon and Stanford, and that was kind of a joke. Like, you know, they're missing these two top 10 teams. It's helping them get used to playing in the Pac-12. Well, this year they have maybe the worst divisional misses of any conference in the country, with Utah is missing Cal and Oregon State, which means they got all the top teams in the North. And I think that's going to make it very hard when you're replacing a whole bunch of starters, a lot of top quality linemen. Now, Utah, which has only 9 starters back, fewest in the conference by 4. So produces a lot of great linemen, and they're probably going to be better than you think. But I think the schedule is going to be tough on them. I think the line of scrimmage will not be something they dominate as they have in the past. And they really don't have a whole lot of things that scare you in terms of the skill positions. I think Utah takes a little bit of a step back this year. I think they're going to be a good football team because they're well coached. I mean, good football team in terms of getting the most out of their talent. But, you know, I don't see them as a big threat in the South this year.
Yeah, and I think until you look at the schedule, you might think 30-31, that's pretty low for Utah, because they've been a contender, what, each of the last 2-3 years? But yeah, when you look at the schedule, it's just, it's tough. I mean, you've got Arizona that's probably a win. You've got Arizona State that's probably a win. But then you've got a whole lot of tough. Stanford, at USC, at Oregon, at Washington. You get UCLA at home. And, you know, even though this probably won't be, you know, one of the best UCLA teams, those games have been dogfights every single year. I don't think I'm ever going to see Utah, you know, be bad under Kyle Whittingham. I just think he's too good of a coach. But this could be a year where they're more like a 6-6, 7-5 type team.
You know, I think they have one of the better front sevens in the Pac-12 still. But I mean, losing so much Joe Williams, I just don't know. I like Troy Williams a lot at quarterback, but just I'm not sure. He needs to take that next step and really be a superstar. They're going to need to rely on him. I don't know, Ted, what you think about him, but if he has a huge year, then I think they at least have a shot. But they do have a lot of stuff a lot of people to replace.
Yeah, I mean, and I mean, it's 4 offensive linemen gone. I mean, I know they've got some guys coming back who have a little bit of experience. You know, a lot of times when you see those departing starters, that especially in those line positions, it kind of gets overrated in some ways, but that's a lot of talent to lose in their bread and butter areas. And they don't have a lot of guys that scare you. I mean, Troy Williams, in terms of who is going to help him, you know, his receivers, you know, his running game, I mean, they lose Joe Williams, who was, you know, had a kind of a strange season last year, but he's incredibly productive when he did play. So, you know, if they do it next year, it will be in a way that's going to surprise me, because I can't really see how they will.
All right, let's move on. I know, Ted, Dave's going to put a lot of money next time he goes to Vegas on this one. This is his favorite squad, 33-1.
Colorado Buffalo.
Yeah, don't dog my Buffs.
I think it's interesting. I feel like a lot of people think that Colorado is kind of like a flash in the pan thing, and I don't see that. I think that their defense obviously is not going to be nearly as good, losing 8 starters, losing Jim Leavitt to Oregon, and but their offense returns pretty much intact. And while they lose their starting quarterback, Montez is a good player. I mean, Steven Montez is a more talented, physically more talented quarterback than Sefo Liofau was. So I think that they're going to be very good on offense. They're going to be very veteran on offense, and that's going to make up for a rebuilding defense in some ways. Now, are they going to win 10 games again? Are they going to win the South? I don't think so. But I definitely think that the days of Colorado being the patsy in the South are done. I mean, this is a team that I think a lot of people probably have in the third or fourth spot who are looking at the roster and you know, not letting themselves be, you know, won over by the flimsiness of just, oh, it's only a one year thing. But I will say, like, going back to the misses here, here's a thing to keep in mind. They're missing Oregon and Stanford. Are those like the top teams in the North? No, but they're in the top four. And those are pretty good misses. So again, that boosts your season and your standing in the South Division if you have those good North misses. And I think Colorado does. And that's going to help them. And I think that'll keep them in the race. I don't think Colorado disappears. And it certainly wouldn't shock me. Like I said, something is bad. It's going to happen to USC for them not to win it. But I think Colorado will be one of those teams that you put a but maybe next to.
Yeah, and if you look at their non-conference too, I mean, they've got a tough matchup to open the year with Colorado State. That's a good Mountain West team, but then they get Texas State and Northern Colorado. So if they, you know, if they need to gel a little bit still on defense,
they'll be well rested.
Breaking in 9 guys, you know, they can practice some things out in those games. There's some stuff they can try out before they get.
Well, and that game at UCLA on the 30th. That's for both teams. You're looking for an early season barometer for where those programs are going. Colorado at UCLA. UCLA needs to hold serve at home. It needs to regain its fan base. And Colorado, you know, I would count it a loss at Washington, but if Colorado starts 0-2 in the Pac-12, maybe some of those feelings from the past show up again. But I think that September 30th matchup in Pasadena is going to be big.
Yeah, I don't expect them to win 10 games and go 8-1 in conference, which is ridiculous. I mean, it's crazy.
Hater.
Huh? No, I'm not hating on your Buffs, but you know, that's my favorite mascot. I think Montez, though, when we saw him and when he had like his own time to, you know, he would do well. When it was like kind of a switching guys in and out, it just didn't seem like he did it well. Now he's going to be the guy. I think it's maybe addition by subtraction. Like one of the key departures for Colorado is Sefo Liofau, but one of the key returners is Steven Montez, I'd say. And I think him just being the guy, I think the offense will take a step forward. It's just so much to replace on defense. I don't know. It could be really tough at times for me.
Yeah. I mean, that defense is going to have some guys that we don't know about right now step up. And it'll be a measure of their recruiting. I mean, how well has Mike McIntyre recruited? It's not like they've been top 25 recruiting classes over the past 3 years, but they were able to put it together last year. And again, like I said, the schedule is fairly favorable. And, you know, if they get some momentum in the early season, which I think a win at UCLA would do, then I would think that if they win that game at UCLA and they're 1-1 in conference play after playing Washington and UCLA, I think they're in pretty good shape.
All right. It's getting a little tighter up here now. It's 16-1. We're going to go up north, and this is a really interesting team for me this year.
Washington State Cougars.
They get a meow.
Very rare. That anybody is ever going to pick. Ask Washington State fans about. You know, yeah. It's difficult for people to pick the team from Pullman to win the Pac-12. I think throughout the conference media, there's a lot of respect for who Washington State is coming back this year. I would think a lot more highly of them if they hadn't just turned in just an awful. I mean, I don't root for teams, but I was so disappointed in their bowl performance in the Holiday Bowl against Minnesota. They just, I don't know, I don't understand that. And like, I had Luke Falk on the phone and I kind of peppered him about it, and he seemed to get irritated with me because he didn't want to talk about it. But they just, they lose some guys at receiver, but otherwise they're going to be really strong on the offensive line. Luke Falk is an NFL prospect at quarterback. They're good at running back, so they're going to be able to run the ball, especially with that offensive line. And they got a lot of guys back on defense. I mean, they don't scare you on defense, but they've got experience and they play good defense in opportunistic situations. If they can just survive, Boise State comes to Pullman on September 9th. I hope that team is motivated to try to get through its non-conference schedule undefeated, because that's been the problem for the Cougs under Mike Leach, is they kind of go bonehead early in the season and then play well when they get to the Pac-12 slate. And, I think the Cougs, it would not shock me if Washington State shocked a lot of other people and ended up winning the North Division. I don't think they're that far behind the Oregons, the Stanfords, the Washingtons. And if things come together in a positive way, this might be Mike Leach's best team since he's been there. Their misses are manageable, Arizona State and UCLA. And, like I said, if they start that non-conference schedule 3-0, I know they have a conference game somewhere in the middle there. Washington State is a top 25 team. And I think they're good enough. They're good enough to win the Pac-12 as a whole if things go their way.
You omitted the most challenging game on this schedule, Ted, which is Montana State.
What's that?
Montana State, the opener.
Is that your alma mater?
No, just FCS, man. FCS, Washington State has issues.
They do.
You look at their bowl performance last year, and then you look at, what is it, two losses now to FCS schools under Leach up there? Do you think those are linked? Because one's essentially an exhibition at the end of the season, and the other one is kind of an opening game where it's assumed you're going to win. Do you think that falls on? Do you think that's just a luck thing? This will happen to all kinds of programs over time, or is there something inherent with either the way Leach runs that program or just Washington State? The current makeup of the program that causes those things to happen.
That's a fair question. I mean, some coaches are great in bowl games. Kyle Whittingham is always wins his bowl game. I mean, what is he, 9-1 in bowl games or something like that? And Washington State under Leach has had some indifferent performances. I know 2 years ago they beat Miami, but that Miami team is going through all sorts of issues with coaches and players and whatnot. And it was a pretty competitive game. But, they had that Colorado State game they had in the bag. They had that game in the bag. And Mike Leach wouldn't admit afterward that he just completely blew his clock management. I mean, the game was over, mathematically over, and he just messed it up.
Yep.
So, you could say that there's some moments of a lack of motivation or intelligence or plan of action or whatever you want to say that kind of falls on Leach at times. But he also has figured out a way to be pretty successful in conference play. So they need to get over that hump. They need to get through that. I mean, you look at their schedule. They're going to be on the road almost the whole second half. So they've got to start fast. They got to beat Montana State. They need to beat Boise State, then Oregon State, Nevada. That's all at home. So they should be 4-0 when USC comes to town. And, I'd still pick USC to win that game. But Pullman is a tough place to play.
Yep.
And I think that a lot of USC fans, Ryan probably remembers Drew Dunning sliding on his knees that time against Carson Palmer. That probably kept USC from winning the 2002 national championship, because that team was probably the best team in the country that year. So, there are some curiosities about that, and I think that if I'm a Washington State fan, I hope my team is got its game face on for the very first game of the season, even if it's an FCS team.
At 16-1, this is probably the first team we've mentioned that I would actually put a few bucks down on. Concerning, like Dave said, about the FCS squad losses, they lost their last three games. The end of the season, you lose Gabe Marks and River Craycraft. They're huge playmakers, but Luke Falk is an absolute stud. Their backfield is great. So I do think they have a real shot. And going 7-2 in conference last year, that was pretty impressive. The weird thing to me, Ted, I wanted you to comment on this. Why the hell is Luke Falk not coming to Pac-12 Media Day? I mean, that just seems ridiculous.
If you want my honest answer, and I guess I can do it, is that I think that it's kind of someone is sticking his thumb in his mouth and biting it at us, and to use a scene from Romeo and Juliet, I think that Mike Leach is going to say, ha, screw you. I can do what I want. I can bring, whomever I want. And, a team we haven't yet talked about, I'm sure we'll do, is like, I honestly, you know, I feel like Josh Rosen is a celebrity and a great story, and the fact UCLA is not bringing him and they're pulling that he's not a senior thing is ridiculous, because everybody knows he's going to be gone at the end of the season. And, you know, with Luke Falk, there's not even that excuse. So, yeah, I think that's boneheaded, especially in this day and age where you're battling for eyeballs. The idea that they wouldn't bring him is you know, unfortunate from a media perspective and unfortunate from a Coug fan perspective. But I do think that that's Mike Leach kind of flexing his muscles. And you know, I love Mike Leach. I mean, and the thing about it is he and I could go back and forth on this and get mad at each other, and he would forget about it within 24 hours and be fine. But I mean, yeah, I hate it when teams do it. You got to bring your stars to media day. And, you know, it's funny how USC has managed to be a pretty successful football program, always bringing its stars to media day.
Yeah, those nickel and diming things are incredible. And if you want the full and complete list of non-seniors that Jim Mora has brought to media day, it is true junior Deion Hollins, true junior Xavier Suofilo, and redshirt freshman, I want to say, Tevin McDonald, his first year. So that's not even a rule that he abides by, so it's crazy.
Is that something Larry Scott should step in and say, look, we need as many eyeballs as we can. You got a superstar potential in Luke Falk. You got a superstar in Josh Rosen. Bring them. I don't care what. Just can Larry Scott do that and just say, look, bring these guys. Just bring them.
Yeah, he should.
You know, I in the past, they've been like, I know that a few years ago, Arizona State was not going to bring Will Sutton. And, you know, that was going to be a coach's decision. And then they changed their mind because I think a lot of people got mad. You know, sometimes it's the player. I mean, I know Luke Falk is not a big fan of interviews. I know Josh Rosen worries, you know, maybe he's the one who worries about him saying the wrong thing more so than even the SID staff there. But I mean, yeah, I would like for that to be something that they say, look, we have media days, these things, we need to get this hype out. And Luke Falk is a guy who, you know, could manage some hype for this conference. I mean, why don't people know more about it? And you could, some people might say that like Luke Falk doesn't want more people to know about him, and Mike Leach is going to support that. But I do think that, you know, it's not media whining. It's like, we're trying to do our jobs well. I mean, honestly, last year with Washington, when they brought, they brought people that most people hadn't heard of. You know, I know who Kevin King was, but I mean, a lot of fans didn't, and they brought their tight end. I've forgotten his name is off the top of my head right now. And no one was talking to him. I mean, this is Washington, a team that was preseason top 10 by a lot of measures, and their players were getting ignored, and everybody's talking to Chris Peterson. And Chris Peterson doesn't like taking questions. I mean, he could have had a bunch of nice features written about Jake Browning and other, you know, superstar players he had in his roster, but he didn't bring them. And, you know, Kevin King was great. I mean, I talked to Kevin King, you know, a great interview, but those were not the superstars of the Huskies roster. So I think that this whole media day thing, it's almost just kind of like a way to thumb their nose at reporters and to do things my way and say I'm in control and not you, and not any type of sentiments outside of my program. And you know, if you're winning games like Chris Peterson is, you can get rid of it, away with it. And if you have a really nice season like Mike Leach did, you can get away with it. But I think that, you know, when you're like Jim Mora and you're kind of embattled now, you know, it just doesn't seem very productive to not bring a guy who's a national figure like Josh Rosen.
Let's move on. 16-1. Also, just like Washington State, we have
Oregon Ducks.
Yeah, Oregon is going to be better this year. I mean, I think they would have been better if they didn't make a coaching change. I think Mark Helfrich, you know, obviously things weren't going very well for them, but I mean, they were playing so many young players last year. You just look at who was playing, and people would say, well, that's recruiting, but I mean, I don't know. I think Oregon was kind of an anomaly last year. I think they're going to be back to a team that wins 8 or 9 games. To me, their moment is that when they announce their return is at home against Nebraska and Mike Riley on September 9th. I think that's a huge game for them to say, hey, we're back to being the Ducks. Because I think they physically, last year, they were every bit the match of Nebraska last year, and they just kept making mistakes to not win the game. I think this year at home, if they beat Nebraska, I think they should beat Nebraska. I think, you know, they've got a quarterback in Justin Herbert who has a lot of potential. He was a true freshman last year and he had some great moments. They've got a lot of their offensive line back who was really young last year. Well, they're not as young this year. They've been in the weight room. They've got energized with a new coaching staff, and they got 9 guys coming back on defense. And Royce Freeman is one of the best running backs in the country. I think Oregon is a legitimate threat in the North. And I think a top 15 type of team if things fall into place. Especially that Nebraska game early is huge. You know, and their misses are pretty fortuitous. I mean, they don't play USC. Washington and Oregon in the north, maybe two front runners up there, don't play the Trojans. And they also miss Colorado. So, I mean, I think things are stacking up pretty well for Willie Taggart in his first season to get the Ducks back on the winning track. I definitely think this team is going to be a lot better than they were last year. I'd be shocked if they weren't a 7-8 or even 9 or 10 win team.
I completely agree. And this, Ryan made the point that Washington State is the first one he would think about putting a little bit of money on. I would definitely consider putting money on Oregon. I'm not giving gambling advice. I'm saying I would definitely consider putting my own money on Oregon. But it does look manageable. Avoiding USC is good. You know, UCLA is talented, but they're not USC by any stretch of the imagination. And, getting Cal, you know, gotta love just being able to play Cal. Even though you're in the North, yeah, you get to play him every year, but you get to play him this year, and that's exciting to think about. You know, there's a semi-challenge.
And Stanford, you know, meanwhile, Stanford, their big competitor, is determined to play the California schools every year. So
yeah,
that forced weekender series always hurts Stanford a little bit, you know, especially when USC and UCLA are good teams, as they should be this year. So, I mean, that's a big boost, I think, for Washington and Oregon, is that, you know, the teams that are in the Northwest, they miss USC every once in a while, and both of those teams do this year. That's a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oregon was 2-7 in conference last year. They have to be better. Nobody got drafted off of this Ducks team. 9 returning starters on defense. I don't know if that's good. They gave up, you know, 41.5 points last year, but they get Jim Levitt from Colorado, so that should help. I do think the defense is going to be better. I like Washington State's chances a little bit better than Oregon's, but I hear what you guys are saying. Royce Freeman has to get back to his form, but if he's good, you know, Herbert's good. If the defense can play better, I think they do have a real shot.
And Washington State has to come to Oregon this year, so I mean it's one of those games. It's kind of a, you know, how does this team, you know, wheel out of there? I mean, they've got a tough stretch there where they get Washington State at home, then they go to Stanford and UCLA, and you know, and obviously if Oregon is back to being its Oregon self. That rival, you know, I would love personally as a fan of the conference and college football in general, it would be just so wonderful if Washington and Oregon were both elite teams. I mean, because the fan bases can't stand each other. I mean, I think it's the most hateful rivalry in the Pac-12. I've been in the middle of it for years. The fan bases can't seem to figure out which one I favor more. I mean, it's just. You know, or hate more or whatever. And I got to admit, I get a kick out of it. I love that rivalry. And I would love for that game on November 4th to have some real stakes in the North Division, because I think that you'd have lots of TV cameras and lots of eyes and lots of emotion in that stadium. But, you know, last year, Washington put a whipping on them. 70 points after losing 12 in a row. You know, Oregon would love to go to Seattle and get things going back in the negative direction for the Huskies. And that's a big game in the conference. And I hope it's a big game in the conference.
Should we move on to the next one, Dave?
Let's do it.
All right. So next up we have at 9-1.
UCLA Bruins.
Gotta love the fact that everybody always kind of thinks, you can never write UCLA off, because you look at their UCLA off, because you look at their roster, these guys got some good players, man. They got some good players. They should do well. And, you know, I don't want to sound like that Being John Malkovich movie, but it is Josh Rosen, Josh Rosen, Josh Rosen. I mean, if Josh Rosen plays the way he should play, which involves not talking, sitting in the mission, you know, listening to his new offensive coordinator, Jed Fish, and doing what he's asked to do and knowing his playbook, And maximizing the talent around him. He is not only going to help this team be a threat in the South, he's going to get himself drafted in the top 5 of the NFL draft in 2018, spring of 18. And because I just think he's a fantastic talent. I mean, he's so smart. He's got such physical ability. And the only reason he hasn't met that promise, besides injuries, is just kind of his belief that he's the smartest guy in the room. And, you know, I wouldn't be saying this. I wouldn't say this about a college athlete unless I've heard it from now multiple, you know, people. And he just needs to humble himself before in front of the process. And I think he will this year. I have a hunch that he might, because I think Jed Fish is not going to take a lot of crap from him. He's an old Harbaugh guy. So I think that UCLA is a legitimate threat to win the South, especially going back to my whole thing about if something goes wrong for USC. Because I think Josh Rosen is that good that if he's playing his best, they could beat anybody. And, you know, I love the early season. I mean, you can talk about a September 3rd game that has a lot of meaning for both head coaches. I mean, Texas A&M coming to California. UCLA should win that football game. They are better than Texas A&M. And that will be a huge moment for Josh Rosen, for Jim Mora, for Kevin Sumlin. And it's a game that I'm really excited to see. That's a little bit off the radar nationally, but it's got a lot of plot line.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I see entirely what you're saying. I think the odds, this is a little high for me. I mean, I would have UCLA probably down in like the 20-1, 16-1 range, just because the offense was so bad last year. And, you know, I think Jed Fish is going to be an upgrade over Kennedy Polamalu because not to speak ill of the departed, but I think it would be hard not to be, especially with his pedigree. But it's just that offensive line wasn't in good shape last year. It's going to be in slightly better shape this year. They got a grad transfer from Miami, Sonny Adogwu, who's going to play right tackle most likely. But it's still, you know, they're one injury away on the offensive line from, you know, playing musical chairs and it not being a good look. So, you know, I think if everyone stays healthy, I think you're completely right. I just, you know, I'm a long-term skeptic of UCLA, so I'm gonna put it down in the 16-1, 10-20-1 range. I probably wouldn't, you know, place a bet at this, but I don't know. What are your thoughts, Ryan?
I mean, I think I told you my theory. The offensive line is the big question for me. You know, giving up 24 sacks last year, under 3 yards per carry. But my theory on Rosen is that he was the man, and then last year when he gets hurt, all you hear about is Sam Darnold, and then you got the NFL stuff too. Jared Goff over there. Philip Rivers coming to town, and now you're talking about him being like the third or fourth best quarterback in the city. It's like, hey, what the heck's going on here? So I kind of feel like he's so confident. He's going to end up taking that and having a chip on his shoulder saying, look, I'm going to show everyone this is why you were talking about me being the chosen one. And I feel he's just going to go out and play lights out and have a really good year. So, I think it's right. Maybe like in the teens or something, low teens. I thought they'd be about where they were. 9-1 might be a little high for odds, but yeah, I do think Rosen's going to step it up this year and play a lot better.
Some pretty big hits on defense. Tack, McKinley, Eddie Vanderdoes, Jayon Brown, Fabian Moreau. Those are NFL players. You know, I mean, I'll be curious to see how good, and I know that people think that some of the youngsters are going to step up, but I think that I almost worry more about the defense being close to what it was last year, which is pretty darn good considering how bad the offense was.
Yep.
Being up to snuff while the offense improves. I think the offensive line, I mean, it's got to get better, right?
I mean, you'd have to think so, worse. Right? Like, it's you know, these things even out, right? Over time, they don't just stay horrible.
All right. So let's go back up north. This is an 8-1 shot to win.
Stanford Cardinals.
I read a story where someone was making a joke about the awful season Stanford had last year. It does seem like people were just like, oh, what happened to Stanford? Well, it was 10-3. You know, they beat Notre Dame, won a bowl game. And, you know, they obviously had that bad experience with the state of Washington. But I, you know, you can't count Stanford out. I mean, they lose some pretty good guys, pretty good receivers, and Christian McCaffrey is obviously the stud on that offense and was the player last year. And Solomon Thomas was the best defensive lineman in the conference last year. But they got a lot of good guys coming back on both sides of the ball, 7 on offense, 8 on defense. I think the quarterback situation, it will be better. I don't know exactly what the time frame is on when Chris is healthy. But, I mean, I think Burns is good enough to do what they do. And I think they're going to get a little bit back to, you know, owning the line of scrimmage. And, the schedule, I just think you can't count Stanford out. I mean, David Shaw is a good coach. I think everybody would agree with that. They have some question marks, but I mean, I think that the misses with Arizona and Colorado are decent. I think that the schedule is pretty decent for them. I mean, they've got Oregon at home. They've got Washington at home. Those would be their top two competitors there. They got to go to Washington State on November 4th. That's a tough game, but I think that Stanford is a little bit like Washington State, and that like I completely would not be shocked at all if the Cardinal. I would not be shocked if Washington State, Stanford, or Oregon wins the North. I just think that that's a group of teams that are top 25 teams, maybe top 15 teams, and I think that the North Division is going to be very competitive. Everybody's going to put it to Washington, but you know, Oregon, Washington State, and Stanford are just behind them.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I would like their schedule a lot better if they flipped that USC and UCLA game and they were doing at UCLA the second game instead of at USC. I think that's, you know, it's tough to say who it's going to be worse for, you know, which team needs to gel more, because Stanford's going to have a pretty experienced offensive line going into that game, but they do have some questions to answer on defense. And, you know, USC also has, you know, maybe some questions still to answer on the offensive line, but I think that one probably plays more in favor of USC. And if you gave Stanford even just, you know, three games to ramp up to that game, I would feel a little bit better about it. But I think Stanford, you know, I think you can say pretty definitively they're the most, you know, consistent program, I think, in the Pac-12, especially over the last 5-6 years. And, you know, I'm expecting them to be a 9-3 team. And that's almost like schedule regardless at this point, just because, you look at David Shaw. Yeah, David Shaw, you know, he will have them ready to play. You know, they might have one trip up game there where, you know, maybe he gets a little creative with his red zone play calling. But for the most part, they're going to be a consistent, you know, 9-3, 10-2 program. And if that's good enough to win the North, then they will. And if, you know, if you needed to go 12-0, maybe not. But if 10-2 is going to do it, I think they have a very good chance.
When I saw 8-1, this is what I thought.
Yeah. Yeah.
This, to me, is the best value on the board that we've seen. I mean, it's, they won their last six games in 2016. The secondary needs to get better, but 8-1 for Stanford, I would put them as like an even thing with Washington. A lot of people have Washington.
And they've been recruiting well. Yeah, they've been recruiting well, too. They got some players we haven't been hearing about. I mean, you guys know more about recruiting than I do, but they got some players that are not on the front burner for the preview sections that are going to be pretty good next year.
All right, we got next up. So these are the last two. We have at 9-5.
Washington Huskies.
Well, you know, if Chris Peterson wasn't the coach, it would be like a prime time for like letdown season after the breakthrough, the dramatic breakthrough. But again, like, missing USC is a big benefit, that you know that everybody's going to be riding in that USC Washington game as an original game for the Pac-12 championship, which could benefit the Pac-12 in a lot of ways instead of having a rematch. That's going to be the final that everybody's picking. Washington's got a lot of good players coming back. Jake Browning, you know, they lose three starters in offense. Now I want to say that I think it was, you know, I told everybody in the preseason that John Ross was going to be a stud, and a lot of people didn't know who he was. Well, everybody knows who he is now, but so that's a big loss to the offense. They take some big hits in the secondary. I mean, three NFL guys in that secondary, but they got a lot of good guys coming back on defense, and the coaching. You got to feel like the culture has been established, a winning culture. They've got a lot of level-headed guys. The guys I interview on that team just have it together. You know, there's not a lot of look-at-me type players on that team. And I think it starts with Jake Browning, who, even after the Pac-12 championship game, he just delighted me with his grumpiness with me. Just, you media guys, he reminded me of Chase Thomas from Stanford. Just always grumpy, even when, you know, people don't respect us. I'm like, Chase, you guys are ranked number two in the country. Oh, they don't respect us. We should be number one. I'm like, oh, God. You know, and Jake Browning's just like that. It's like he's always got somebody somewhere that's bothering him, and I think that's how he feels himself. And I'm sure he'll hear the people, you know, talk about his kind of inconsistency last year, maybe, you know, using a guy like John Ross, who is the fastest guy in the Pac-12, to catch those passes and make his stats look good. But I just think almost everybody is going to have Washington winning the North and USC winning the South, and that the people who don't go that direction are going to be doing so just to be different. I mean, those are the two most talented teams. Those are the teams that seem to have it together in terms of coaching. And Chris Peterson, I mean, let's face it. I mean, he is one of the super heavyweights in college football. And you know what? He's got a good staff around him. Kwiatkowski on defense has done a great job there. They've been good after rebuilding before. It's easy to be confident on this team. It's easy to be confident with the Huskies as a national power again.
Yeah, and if you look at the schedule, it sets up really nicely for them to start the season. Ooh, gosh, 8-0,
7-0. That's some weak stuff. That's weak stuff in the non-conference.
Yeah, you go Rutgers, Montana, Fresno State, which should all be relatively easy wins. You've got at Colorado to open conference play, which I'm not going to say is going to be a cakewalk, but they should win that game. And then it's at Oregon State, California, and at Arizona State, all of which should be wins. They should be favored by, I would think, at least a touchdown in every single one of those games. And against Cal, they're going to be favored by about four of those. And then UCLA, a talented team, but they get them at home. And UCLA, you know, we talked about their issues. And then Oregon at home, I think, is going to be a legitimately challenging game. And we talked about that in the Oregon section. But, I mean, I would pick them to be 8-0 through eight games. I mean, I look at that schedule and I think, you know, probably the aggregate odds would have them at 7-1 or something in that stretch. But I would pick them to be 8-0, you know, heading into Oregon on November 4th. Yeah. I mean, even with their losses, there's just not a whole lot of challenge in that schedule.
I think when you see Jake Browning play his best, it's like, you know, if the competition isn't as good, I mean, they just seem to dominate, you know, and there's a lot of that in the beginning part of the schedule. They should dominate. They're not a team that seems like they trip up against teams that aren't that talented that they should beat. The teams that they should beat with Chris Peterson and Jake Browning, they seem to beat them. So yeah, I agree with you, Dave. I think that's an 8-0 start is really likely.
And then 2-2 is totally possible over the last four games because they got Oregon at Stanford, Utah, and Washington State. And those are, you know, maybe they're four, you know, UCLA, you could probably throw them in that mix. But they're five toughest opponents come in the last five games, most likely.
Huh. Yep. Yeah, but you know what? Good news for them is those last five games, four at home. And Husky Stadium is legitimately, I'd say, you know, at peak Husky Stadium, it's the toughest to play in the conference. I know Oregon fans are going to jump on me on that one, but, you know, and USC fans too. But, you know, that place is rowdy when that team is on. And I think it's going to be rowdy for those games.
Why do you hate Oregon so much, Ted? That's what I was always wondering, because you always seem to hate Oregon.
Yeah. No, you really hate Oregon.
You hate Washington too, man. Why do you hate Washington so much?
Why do you hate the Pac-12 so much, Ted?
I do, man. I'm a hater. I'm pure and simple a hater.
All right.
The best one was when I had a USC fan get on me on Twitter about 6 months ago, and it was actually pretty funny because a bunch of USC fans go, "Did you just arrive here? Did you just get here? I mean, this is the guy who's been defending us against the NCAA for years and stuff like that." It was funny because he got kind of bombarded by some of the USC fans that maybe were older than 12, but it was funny. Just this, you hate USC. I'm like, what?
Yeah, I think I remember that. That was like,
really?
It made it on our message board where everyone was defending you, which was good. But there's always like one or two idiots that are just think like that guy hates us or whatever, you know. Well, speaking of, so the one last team. This is a 10-11. So you got to bet $11 to win 10. Is
USC Trojans.
You know, I think those are lousy odds because who would ever make that bet? Because, you know, there's always so many variables there. But, I mean, you know what? I mean, if you watched the Rose Bowl last year, if you listened to Kirk Herbstreit's commentary where he was just in awe of Sam Darnold. I mean, I keep saying it to people. Marcus Mariota was a fantastic quarterback. And Carson Palmer was an amazing talent who peaked his senior year. Matt Leinart did so much. I think Sam Darnold, to me, has the most potential in terms of all parts of his game, athletic ability to arm, to accuracy, to makeup, to the way he interacts with his teammates, to his just kind of chill way of being. I love he's a great basketball player. I think he's going to win the Heisman Trophy this year, and I think he's the best player in college football, and I think he's going to deserve it, and I think he's going to put up epic numbers, and I love the talent coming. I mean, you know, they don't have as many starters as a lot of guys coming back, but USC never does. And, I mean, there are questions on the offensive line. You know, they lost some pretty good players. But and receiver, I guess, you always like to have Juju around. But I look at USC, and I think national contender. I think the defense is going to be better with Clancy Pendergast in year two. I think that I think the coaching staff has found its rhythm. I love Clay Helton's chill, and it just matches up with T. Martin and Clancy. And I like the way the direction of the program. And I don't think those past bugaboos that hit Lane Kiffin and Steve Sarkisian, because those guys got distracted. That's nothing about Clay Helton that gets distracted. He just wants to coach football. And, you know, they got some tests early. I mean, second week. I mean, Western Michigan's no patsy after, you know, earning a way into a BCS type bowl game last year against Wisconsin. I mean, it's no patsy, and they got Stanford and Texas. I mean, those are losable games early on, even though they're at home. But I think that USC has the potential, if they do their thing, of going unbeaten and being in the playoff. I think they're that good, and I think Sam Darnold's that good.
Yeah, I 100% agree with everything you said. Starting with the garbage odds, you know, USC is definitely my favorite. My odds on huge favorite to win the Pac-12, but 11. I mean, why would you even make that bet?
No.
But yeah, I mean, look at the schedule.
$11.
They even get the easy. I mean, to your point, they even get the easy breakdown of opponents in the North. There's so much I like about the schedule. The non-conference is certainly tough, but they're better than Western Michigan, even though that's a Western Michigan team that nearly went undefeated last year. They're going to be better than Tom Herman's Texas in his first year. Now, if this was a year from now and they had to play Texas, maybe it'd be a slightly different story, but they're going to be better than first year of Tom Herman's Texas. And they're better than a Notre Dame team that's going to be better than 4-8, but they're not going to be an 11-1 Notre Dame team suddenly. Sam Darnold, I pretty much agree with everything you said. He's got that unnatural feel where, yeah, he's got a strong arm, and yeah, he's pretty accurate and all that other stuff, but just guys don't even touch him. Like, he'll have rusher, like some quarterbacks, if there's one rusher coming at him, he can't avoid him. Darnold has that ability to just kind of pirouette between three different guys and then pinpoint a guy, 25 yards downfield. And you just can't really, that's not even a thing you teach. That's just something that's a little bit innate. And he has that. And I think, even if you have questions about the offensive line or a few different, whether they're going to replace Juju or all that stuff, they've got that guy. And as long as he doesn't get hurt, it's hard to see that offense not being spectacular this year.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't touch these odds either. And then I would still pick him as the favorite, but like a 2-1 or something, not like 10-11. But so they do rely on Sam Darnold a lot. He's a, generational talent. But if something happens to him or he doesn't have his great, great year, I think they're going to be in trouble. They're going to rely on him quite a bit. And there's a lot of parallels between 2017 USC and 2012 where, there was all this hype coming into the season and they were preseason number one, number two, whatever. And then they end up going 7-6. I don't think that's going to happen. I think Ted mentioned this, like there was a lot of distractions with Lane Kiffin and Steve Sarkisian. I don't think you see those same kind of things. Clay Helton's more of just a, no nonsense. He's just coaching football. He's not trying to do, all these crazy things. Lane Kiffin's all the antics off the field. There were so many things going in that 2012 season where they just fell flat on their face. I don't see that happening, but there's slip-ups for sure on the schedule that could happen. Playing Washington State Friday night on the road after a back-to-back road game. It's against Cal, but still. 6 days rest, two road games in a row, and you're playing Washington State and Pullman at night. I mean, that's a little crazy. I mean, there's places they can lose. They could lose to Stanford easily second game of the season. They lose them fairly often. So there's a lot of hiccups potential. So I wouldn't take these odds, but I would still have them as the favorite.
Yeah, but they're all hiccups. Like, they'd have to be substantially worse than everyone thinks they are. Darnold would have to be substantially worse than we all think he is, or he'd have to get hurt for them to lose three games. Like, losing three games would be very, very tough with how good Darnold is. Yeah. It's hard to see.
And he just doesn't seem like a guy who's going to have that so-called sophomore slump. I mean, I think something has to happen weird for U.S., like just epidemic injuries starting with Darnold, for something to go on. Now, like you said, that Stanford game, that game is always kind of been a nemesis for both teams. Usually the team that's higher thought of loses it.
Yep.
Stanford went down to USC a couple times when they were in the national title contention. So, that's out there and really an early season game that's kind of a measuring stick for them. I mean, that's a rough schedule. I mean, they don't have, like you said, I mean, they got Cal, but I mean, with the non-conference schedule, all of those are challenging teams. They'll get credit for playing challenging non-conference teams, but they're all winnable. I mean, Texas is winnable. Notre Dame is winnable. Western Michigan obviously is winnable. I mean, it's just, they're going to get credit for playing a tough schedule while also being the better, more talented team on the field for 12 games. And I think that matters. And again, like I said, Lane Kiffin was worrying about silly things, just getting mad at the media, trying to, the inflating football, all those different things that he got distracted by. Like, Helton is not going to do that. I mean, Helton is going to coach his football team. And I think he's got a, you know, I think he's got a chance to win a national championship here. And you know what? That would not be shocking kind of in USC's history, that usually their distinguished coaches turn things around pretty quickly there.
Dave, we've already gone like almost an hour and 20 minutes. I feel like we've kept our guests quite a long time. I know we have questions and stuff, but you think we should wrap this up?
Yeah, let's wrap up. We can let's try to do another one next week, actually, and preview media days and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, let's tackle those next week. So if we didn't get to your question, we're sorry, but we don't want to keep Ted for the rest of his life here on this podcast.
Yeah. I feel bad. Like, we didn't give you, like, usually they're like 20 minutes, half an hour, like hour and 20 minutes of your life we just stole. I'm sorry about that.
Well, I don't know if it was your fault. You could see, like, maybe I haven't been doing a lot of talking about college football. It just kind of came out in, like, this sort of quasi-diarrhea of the mouth. I was like, man, I'm being long-winded today, aren't I?
It was great. It was great. That was more thorough than we ever have the even capability of being. So that was great. I think our listeners will enjoy education about college football for once.
And we do appreciate it. Cool. Thanks so much for coming on and joining us.
Absolutely. Hopefully we'll cross paths down the road, guys.
All right.
Thanks, Ted.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ted. That's Ted Miller. Does a great job covering the Pac-12. We hope to see him soon. So follow him on Twitter and find out where his next exploits will be. For David Woods, this is Ryan Abraham. We are the Podcast of Champions. Thanks for tuning in, and we will talk to you next time.